Hello, welcome to episode 6 of the Gestalten podcast. My name is Eric Galina.
My name is Martin Groschwald.
And we have a very special episode for you today. Now, I'd like to first of all kick off because there's been something quite interesting that's happened this week was Giorgetto Giugiaro's 80th birthday. He turned 80 on August 7th, which was just yesterday, I believe. This is one of the most iconic figures in automotive design. This is a guy that started out at Bertone very young, moved into creating a whole range of cars for a number of automakers. I mean, he was responsible for the BMW M1. He was responsible for Hyundai's first ever car, the Pony. He was also responsible for, just a Lotus Esprit. I mean, there's
first generation Golf.
First generation Golf is absolutely a huge, huge win for him. And then he went on to design a series of Volkswagens after that. Now, the question really is, you know, there's a few designers that reached a certain level in their career that then went on to open their own design studios. But, you know, Giorgetto is a master.
Yeah.
He's one of the guys, I mean, you know, this is dating back to the 1960s when he originally opened his design studio and designed all of these cars that I spoke about. He also designed, you know, computers and cameras. I mean, he even designed pasta. Like, this is, so he's all over the map. And, you know, after Volkswagen kind of bought him out and then gradually, you know, they bought a controlling stake in the company, then they bought more. And Giorgetto, I guess, didn't really like working for this larger corporation. I really don't know. I mean, obviously, he got in because Walter De Silva and him had a very good track record over the many years that they worked together. But, you know, after he left, you know, he started his own company now with his son, Fabrizio, a car that was unveiled in Geneva very recently. So GFG design, Giorgetto, Fabrizio, Giugiaro. But the thing that strikes me is the fact that whilst some design directors, Loewy Vermeersch, for example, went off to create Grand Studio, there's a couple of design directors that Ken Okuyama, for example, left Pininfarina. There's a few of these designers that went off and started their own thing, but it's a different game now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can't go and say, I designed that, like Giorgetto can say.
Yeah, and I think the whole design studio environment has changed massively. I mean, if we look back into, you know, the 60s, the 70s in particular, it was not common to have a design studio. The money wasn't, you know, let's say that much put into the design studios. It wasn't, you know, that obvious to have, you know, what you have with Mercedes or like, you know, BMW, 400-500 people working in design and developing a new strategy. I think it really came down to the fact that he was with his ideas at the right, you know, at the right spot, at the right time. And it would just won't happen again. I think if we look into, you know, certain kind of companies, what are they doing nowadays? We look into Pininfarina, we look into, you know, even someone like Machina, someone like, you know, Giugiaro himself. Those kind of guys, what they're doing is pretty much pre-work. So they're working in very, very early stages of a design process. So they become, you know, an external competing factor for the teams. And I think we will see those. We will see those companies, you know, developing. We will see those companies, obviously, you know, surviving. But in terms of really doing production cars, it's not really going to happen anymore.
Right.
You know, I think with that, that time is unfortunately over. You know, you might have the occasional, freelance designer that might come in and helps you on that one. But those kind of leading positions, you know, Giugiaro coming in, let's do that car, it's not going to happen anymore.
Yeah, I agree. And it's sad, but again, you know, it's the end of an era. Again, you know, this is a question to you guys. If you guys want to drop a comment in the comment section below, or, you know, just let us know your thoughts. I mean, will we ever get back to that point where, you know, a designer can attain that level, that iconic status that Giorgetto has? I mean, he won Designer of the Century back in 1999, so almost 20 years ago. And I doubt that, you know, there were quite a lot of candidates up against him, but, you know, no one can really hold a candle to what he's achieved over the course of his career. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, so moving on now to there haven't been many new cars revealed.
No, unfortunately not. There was a little bit of a week, 2 weeks, I would say, yeah, since yeah. we last recorded. So, but we came up with something else that still has to do with new cars.
Yes. I mean, it is a new car that's been revealed recently, you know, but it's summer and people are away on holiday. You know, I mean, the all the automakers are taking breaks and whatever, being, you know, cycling around Europe or whatever. But the Buick Regal Avenir made its debut. And that obviously is a car that's catering to the Chinese
what's a name market. As well. What's a name?
Yes. but I mean, Buick, you know, is a massive brand in China. And that concept car, the Avenir, was when it was unveiled in Detroit several years back now. I really thought that, and I think Ed Welburn at the time, GM's vice president of design, told me that they were contemplating and considering putting the Avenir nameplate mm-hmm. into production. Now, it probably, you know, wouldn't have gone over too smoothly because obviously Cadillac exists on the upper end for GM. But it's interesting in that, you know, just like when we were talking earlier about Giugiaro in the 60s, and I mean, back in the 60s in Italy, there were a lot of carrozzeria, mm-hmm. and two of which, you know, Ghia and then later Vignali as well, were acquired by Ford. And Ford basically decided that they were going to take these brands. Ghia in the 80s became, I think it was the 80s, maybe even before that, but became then a trim level on Ford's existing products. They didn't really do much after that. And the same thing in recent times in the late 20s or the early 2010s, I would say, with Vignale happened. And this is exactly what's happening now with the Buick brand, because this is the third vehicle that they've created with the Avenir kind of at the upper end of the trim. Now it's just a trim level, so it's kind of different, as it's not what it, you know, what Vignale was or what Ghia mm-hmm. was. But clearly, I mean, developing a new brand from scratch. And again, for GM, this may not have worked because obviously it goes head to head with against Cadillac. But Cadillac is unknown in China, which is where GM mm-hmm. is selling massive amounts of yeah. Buicks. So, but to invest that level of money to make Avenir a brand like, for example, Lexus or Infiniti, a premium, you know, luxury brand like Genesis has done very recently, is very interesting. I was curious to hear your kind of take on, you know, trim levels versus, you know, adding a new luxury premium brand into the market.
Yeah, I think it very much depends on what the whole company has to offer. Yeah, I mean, if we look into the kind of, or if we analyze a little bit at the moment, for example, what happened with, you know, Opel Vauxhall, you know, and moving into PSA, a lot of people were asking, like, how does this make sense? So if we analyze that to a certain kind of degree, we could say, well, maybe Opel is moving into a more of a premium sector. Yeah. So obviously there is the DS brand, which is supposed to be very, very premium, very, very high level, but there is still enough space because the idea of PSA, you know, Peugeot, Citroën and Opel are so close together. The question is, like, how can you diversify it? Mm-hmm. But this costs a hell of a lot of money. Yeah. And we've seen something, you know, in terms of just establishing a brand just in general costs a lot of money. Establishing a premium brand or a luxury brand mm-hmm. is not just about, you know, good marketing. It's not just about good design. It's mainly about building a brand, you know, from almost scratch, and building it up a way that everybody who works in it understands what premium is all about.
Absolutely.
And I think this is nowadays very, very difficult, because if you think about what is the goal of the car industry, is to sell more cars. We see a fight between, you know, Toyota and the Renault Mitsubishi and the Nissan Alliance and Volkswagen Group. It's like, oh, you know, we can sell more and more cars. Ooh. Is premium the whole thing, or is it just about, you know, selling as many cars as you want to? So really establishing into the premium market is difficult. And, you know, if you ask the question, just like, who do you run against? I mean, how do you want to compete with 100 years of Mercedes experience, 100, you know, 100 years of BMW experience when you start from scratch, you know? And I think you need to be bold. And, you know, when we talk about bold and daring, Genesis obviously comes to mind, but then look at, you know, the idea of the Essentia versus a G80 and a G90. They are miles apart.
Yes. Yes. But again, I mean, that's a concept vehicle and the team is fairly new.
Yeah.
Many of them have not had occasion to work on a production vehicle.
For Genesis, yeah.
What we will see coming out of that studio or coming out of Genesis in general from, you know, the three studios is going to be impressive because of this newfound team. Without a doubt, it's going to be quite different than what we've seen, certainly in the early stages of Genesis. So it's something that's very interesting and something that I'm really looking forward to. But yeah, I mean, developing brands and new brands is very costly. But obviously, the way forward is to develop these new premium brands because the profit margins are massive.
Yeah.
But you have to develop them in a certain way where you're going to elevate the perception of the brand. And that's really the critical word is the perception, because if no one knows who you are, you need to present yourself with a certain way where people will automatically equate your brand with, it has to be synonymous with luxury or whatever message you're trying to convey.
And I think the interesting thing nowadays when we talk about the new generation of cars, luxury can be seen in different levels. We can go back onto a Rolls-Royce level, which is then, you know, luxury in terms of materials that you're using, in terms of bespoke design. But we can also talk about technology. If we look into a Tesla, for example, the Tesla in terms of materials and quality is not that great. Let's be very, very honest. You know, it's a good vehicle, but it's nowhere close to competing with the Mercedes. In price it is, and it makes it up for like having new technology, having the EV, you know, the EV setup, but also having the, let's say, touchscreen that goes in hand with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we really need to understand nowadays there's different kind of levels of luxury. And I think this is where it becomes extremely interesting in the future for us to discuss what kind of group of people prefer what kind of luxury. Yeah, and that's going to be interesting to see, especially from a technology perspective.
Absolutely, I agree. Yeah, technology is opening a whole new realm, and yeah, you're right. I mean, the perception people now, you know, consider technology such as electric vehicles to be some form of luxury because it's avant-garde, it's new, and so that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Right. So, we're going to be going to Pebble Beach later this month.
I'm not, you are. I am actually going to be on holiday.
Yeah,
happy days.
Guy's
Eric is going to enjoy the California sun.
Enjoy the California sun. I mean, no, somebody's got to do it. But yes, so I'm sure we're going to see quite a lot of interesting projects, including Genesis, and, you know, quite a lot of interesting debuts, probably some surprises. So that's something that I'm definitely looking forward to.
One of the best shows of the year, I think, for now.
It's very interesting because it kind of brings us back to what we were talking about last week or 2 weeks ago, which is how manufacturers are basically, the auto show, the traditional auto show, is dead. And we're moving towards now new ways of reaching customers for these manufacturers that are exhibiting now in the Quail or Pebble Beach on the concept car lawn, or, maybe outside of some restaurant in Carmel where there's going to be just a ridiculous amount of cars, all of which I'll be posting on Instagram.
But okay. we've heard some cool kind of rumors coming out that obviously Audi has shown a teaser.
That's right.
There were some rumors, but like, you know, there was no substantial, like, you know, proof to it that, you know, Bugatti might show a very, very first early stage of the Devo, I think it's called, the new kind of, you know, potentially a Chiron. you know, successor, which would be super exciting, I think.
Yes.
So
I've seen the one with the glass roof.
That is not a successor of the Chiron. It's actually a Chiron special edition with like the sunroof. Edition. I think it's actually called the sunroof edition or something like that. But
I don't know what it's called. But I figured, you know, Bugatti doesn't really change like that much. So if they did show something new in Pebble, I would be really surprised, and that would be amazing. yeah, I think the sunroof thing is kind of. That's it. I don't know. I could be pleasantly surprised. Who knows?
So you see that, you know, there's really not that many new cars if we have to talk about the sunroof in a Bugatti Chiron. That has happened over the past couple of weeks. But yeah, Pebble Beach is going to be cool. So in that kind of regards, of course, you know, follow Eric on Instagram and on all the social medias, because he's going to be posting some really, really cool pictures.
Yeah, if I've got internet reception, which, you know, we'll see. But so now moving into the main topic. The main topic this week is one that we, you know a lot about, being as it is,
hopefully.
Hopefully. I mean, it's something that I want to discuss because it's something that Concept House is, you know, very much intertwined with, and that is the designers and the studio structures that these designers work in. So, you know, it's a topic that, you know, I wanted to address, and basically just to shed some light on. A lot of people don't really know how things are run, certainly not, you know, people that aren't designers working in these environments. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, consider what manufacturers feed out and, you know, seeing in terms of like the face of the brand as being the designer of. And, you know, so people like, say, Ian Callum from Jaguar, you know, he's been better lately in terms of bringing out his team and showcasing. But nonetheless, when you speak or see, you know, how these people are portrayed in the media, it's always, you know, Gordon Wagner is the designer of.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really work that way.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. The structure of a design department is something that is very particular. It is also something that is, let's say, very, it can be very simple to describe, but it's a very, very complex structure. You know, and it's also something that, even though it has a structure that kind of, you know, applies for every design studio in the world, there are certain kind of levels that might differ. And, so we will just move into that in just a little bit. But before we do that, we would like to bring someone in for this whole topic, because there's one thing about the design studios. And, you know, when you, you know, when we cut back to this, we will have Daniel with us, is one of our colleagues. And Daniel will tell us a little bit more about, you know, his part of the whole idea. So, you know, we will be back with Daniel in just a few minutes.
All right. So welcome back. We now have a special guest joining us, Daniel Schoenfeld, who is the counterpart to Martin at Concept House. So, Daniel, tell us a little bit, how did you guys meet?
It's quite funny, actually, because we met in 2014 in London, when we were both working for the same agency. And he actually was there, I think, for most like nearly a year, and when I joined, I obviously was quite junior, and I really expected to like join a team of like native English people, really, like obviously being based in the UK. Turned out it was like a team of 10 and everyone was from Stuttgart area. So, you know, being from Hanover, quite having to deal with like this funny accent they are having. I think we met in like after the first week was just flying, and we got along quite well. And then 2 years later, basically, we decided, obviously, to establish Concept House in 2016. And
now we're here.
There we are.
That's pretty much it.
Nice. So you guys are, like, having been in this industry, working with designers, building these studios and these teams that are working within these studios, you guys are perfectly placed to talk about what it is that really takes place within these studios in terms of designing cars and all of the people that come into play in terms of design. So I think really, I want, I want to just throw a scenario out here for you. So my name is Eric. I'm a gajillionaire. I've got more money than I know what to do with. I wipe my butt with it. And I want to build a car. I got the Gestalten brand. I'm set. I'm ready. How would I get a car designed and built from nothing?
Go to Tijaro.
Well, you know, that's not really an option.
If you would be in the 60s now.
But no. I'm a guy that wants everything done myself. I'm going to build it. I'm going to pour the concrete down. You know what I mean? I'm going to build the building, the facility, and bring in all the people to make my car and build my company. Because it's not going to be just one car. It's the Stalton brand. And we're going to build
the range of products. We go all the way.
We're going to sell globally. So I want, first of all, I need a design team. I need to build something.
Yeah.
You know, I need to design something that I'm then going to build. Talk me through it. How would I do that?
Well, the first thing that you will need, of course, is a guy that's at the helm of the whole thing. You know, you need a guy who's running the design, who has a vision of building not just a brand, but building a team, you know, a studio environment that people feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to do that, that's super difficult. You know, you will find people that are made to do something like that. There are other people that are, you know, stuck in corporate life, and they will always be stuck in corporate life. So let's say in our case, we have someone who is absolutely perfect what the Gestalten brand is supposed to be like. Mm. So a lot of people, especially when, you know, you look into the media, it sounds like, oh, you know, Gordon Wagoner is the only designer at Mercedes, which not obviously is not really the case. You know, Gordon has a very, very big team behind him. So it's a very, very complex and time consuming and, you know, financially intensive situation that we have to build, and like, you know, team that we have to build. But the general kind of overview from a design perspective is it's extremely complex. We have a team of designers, and that team of designers is usually split in, it used to be three, now it's four different areas. Mm-hmm. First one is obviously just normal exterior design. Pretty much we don't have to talk about that in detail. It's about the shell of the car. It's about the outer experience of the car, you know, the outside experience of everything. Then we have an interior team, and this interior team is, you know, what we call nowadays mostly a geometry team. So they play really with, you know, the volumes of the car on the inside, with everything that is haptic, so everything that you can touch on the car. And over the past few years, we really had additions to that team, which was from the digital side, what a lot of people now call UI, UX, HMI. You know, there's different kind of product names for that, or like, you know, digital product or whatever you want to call it. This can also be a separate kind of entity, a separate kind of team, which very much then depends on, you know, where you put the focus, if the digital is more important than the geometry, for example. So that's already three of pretty much what we have. And one of the most underrated departments in anything that has to do with design is color and trim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But does that normally sit within interior design?
No. Color and trim is usually separate from everything, because colors go literally from, you know, I mean, we have the little bobblehead down there, goes from the silver to everything that happens on the inside. And color and trim is actually interesting in the sense of it always goes into product design as well. Yeah, so we're talking about materials that have to be sourced. Colors need to be created. It sounds like, you know, always so easy, oh, let's put a color on the car. Those colors are specifically created for a brand. You know, we talked about luxury earlier. It's a really important kind of factor of implementing it as well. But this, of course, gives us a intellectual idea, you know, something that is an idea. But we, you know, we cannot build a car just with sketches. Yeah. It's just absolutely impossible.
But I mean, the color and materials team, I always believe that would sit underneath the interior team in terms of level, shall we say, because obviously there's the exteriors, which have until this day reigned supreme. Interiors is kind of catching up from a general perspective now. And you have this new field of design, which is coming into play, which is UI UX, which in my opinion should be entirely separate from interiors. Obviously UI UX, you're talking about haptic feedback and things. So yes, in terms of like points of contact, but from an exterior perspective, it's also an experience, isn't it?
This is exactly the thing where we're getting into, let's say, a lot of you know, definition problems. Because if we look into a Byton, for example, the Byton in its concept form doesn't have, you know, any kind of ways to open the door apart from a facial recognition mm-hmm. or from an app. I mean, Tesla has, you know, the app to open up your car. So the experience level is going pretty much everywhere nowadays. Mm-hmm. We're going even on a, you know, corporate level with, in terms of experience. So you can see already the importance of certain kind of sub departments within design, yeah, that a design director really has to coordinate in that situation. And color and trim is exactly like that. Color and trim becomes more and more important because the idea of individualization, of bespoke, yeah, is an ongoing process. You know, you see it with Rolls-Royce, for example. Yeah. Probably color and trim is the most important department for Rolls-Royce because it's ever evolving. You know, we see it in a BMW i3, we see it in a BMW i8. They try to use materials, you know, that show the idea of the car.
Absolutely, and differentiate the product, make it stand out from the competition.
Exactly, and this is why, you know, always very, very underestimated in terms of what they're doing, the color and trim designers. Mostly female, actually. I think this is the interesting point of this. Whereas the interior, exterior,
very male dominated.
Very male dominated, and definitely one of the most important thing nowadays.
Yeah. So once you get past, which is what I'm going to call, you know, the design director, the face of the brand, because that's how they're portrayed across every media. I mean, design obviously is gaining massive importance across every market, and people are really noticing, you know, the power of design, and therefore they need a face to represent that for the brand. Then below them, you have a design director responsible for interiors, responsible for exteriors.
Correct.
And, excuse me. Now, then you also have the color and trim team, and you also have the UX team.
Yeah.
Now, if I was building my Gestalten car, how would you structure that? Would you put them side by side next to the interior design directors?
Yeah, they should. They should. I think in a modern day culture, especially with the idea of technology becoming ever important. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you could even go as far, and I say something controversial now, and people like, you know, I would really love people to comment on that one. Mm-hmm. You could even go as far as putting the UI and the UX team above an interior team.
Mm.
Yeah, so you could actually say interior and color and trim is all right, and if you don't want to have another hierarchy structure, you could put UI UX on the very, very helm of the whole thing.
Okay.
This is obviously very, very forward thinking. We're pushing quite a lot with that, you know, with that kind of idea that we bring into play here. Mm-hmm. But it is a very, very good possibility, and I'm expecting to see this at some point in the future.
Right. Yeah?
Because the idea of a geometry in terms of interiors, you know, and again, we see that with the Byton, we see that with the Tesla, is the screen's becoming ever present. Mm. And so then the content in the screen is going to be part of it. You know, the experience, what do you want to do with the screens? They're really moving in into the whole situation. We saw with the Audi that it's much more clean on the interior now and stuff like that. So it's really then down to how risking is the design VP, you know, whatever that official you know, name for the first person is in design.
Yes.
How tech savvy is that person, for example?
Right. How future looking?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
This is the fundamental question.
Mm.
But the general kind of put would really be you put them all onto one level. They all have the same right, and that's pretty much it.
And then within those structures, then you've got design managers. You've got senior designers, and then you're going down to junior designers. Now, the difference between the design managers is obviously someone within that interior or that exterior or that UX team overlooking the work that other people are doing. Now, within that team, then you've got senior designers, which are roughly, I mean, how much experience does a senior designer have?
I mean, it very, very much depends. I think one thing that we need to put in there is that within a design department, generally, there are some exceptions. I think the UK is an area where this is not always applicable. And this is where we then differentiate, of course, is the design department is very permanent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's very, very few contract work in there in general because you want to have the stability of the work. Yeah, with everything in there.
Everybody singing from the same hymn book.
Exactly.
The design, the... Yes.
And if you have, it might be very helpful someone to have, you know, sometimes to have a contractor coming in for a year or so. Mm-hmm. But the general kind of idea is we want to have a constant workflow. Yeah, that's not going to change much and it's going to be constantly going. So That's the idea.
But it's also sometimes helpful, I'd assume, to bring in contract designers with a completely different viewpoint, which could then integrate well with the team, of course, but come and look at it from a different perspective.
Sure. Especially with, I mean, in the German environment, this doesn't really happen.
It has on a few occasions.
Back in the day, yes. I mean, Martin Longmore is a good example
that. Audi TT.
Exactly. It's not really that common anymore. But coming back to your initial question.
Yes.
You have certain kind of experience levels, you know, and the experience levels, they have had a kind of, let's say, resurrection lately in terms of cool names and what you can call them. But it really comes down to the experience, and then it comes down to the studio environment. I mean, if we take our example now, we built the Gestalten car, we want to put it into production. Yeah. Mm. So for our purpose, a senior designer would be someone that can really help and has the experience to bring a car into a production level. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some other companies really go just after experience. They don't care, like, you know, what kind of projects you've worked on. It's like you have 8 years of experience, so you're now a senior designer.
Right.
Yeah. Has to do with like promoting factors internally and stuff like that. But the general kind of idea is to say, very much depending what you want to do. Yeah. And if you then say, I want to work in a production environment, okay, then if you want to be a senior designer there, you have to have experience in certain kind of production levels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Juniors have a completely different kind of status in that company. Yeah.
Yes.
Juniors.
Well, the term sketch monkey is what I've heard.
Sketch monkey is a very, very bad term, which is unfortunately true for a lot of companies.
Mm. They're the idea generators. I mean, they're the younger generation, the guys that come in with a whole lot of energy and a completely different viewpoint.
Exactly. I mean, the idea sketch monkey, just to kind of explain this to everybody, because we love it so much. A sketch monkey would pretty much be a company, or like, you know, a company working with sketch monkeys is they hire 10, 15 junior guys. They all sketch like the hell out of the whole thing. And after a year, they would say, five survive.
Mm.
That's the idea of a sketch monkey. Yeah, it's not the idea of like I'm pushing a junior to become better and better. It's more just like, you know, I'm bringing all those kind of guys in. I hope one idea is going to be good. If this idea is good, we're going to do it. And if not, well, get rid of everybody.
Mm.
Yeah. So this does happen. Yeah. And unfortunately, it is the case. And we see that not more and more, but, you know, due to the fact that we have more design schools that produce more junior designers.
Yes.
It is more likely to happen than it was probably 10, 15
years ago. Well, competition is intense. Yeah. I mean, there's so many designers graduating from schools now, and there's a lot less positions being available. Well, I mean, that's actually not true, because there's, if they choose to expand their horizons, if everybody wants to go into exterior, which is traditionally the way that most designers
don't
think,
do that,
then they're not going to get a lot of jobs, because there's so much competition in terms of wanting to be an exterior designer.
Yeah.
But if you expand your horizons a little bit and want to get into UI UX, or, you know, you're killer at Alias, or, you know, then you stand a better chance of actually making it in this business.
Yeah. And
makes you more attractive as well when you know.
Exactly. And, you know, this is what we just described. And you know, what we just described is pretty much on par with everything that happens in a creative background. It doesn't really matter if that's interior, exterior, whatever, color and trim. This is kind of applicable for every subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we're still in a position where we're not being able to produce anything whatsoever. We're in an ideation phase, you know, the experience then comes in the execution of the project, but we need different, you know, we need way more people to actually finish the execution. So I would say in terms of a ratio, you know, we would probably have 25% maximum of a design department nowadays. Maybe a third, if depending on, like, you know, how you operate, is actually designers. So the people who sketch, you know, and this is the, I would say the a very, very big last resort in this kind of second, or like, you know, first line reporting directly to the manager, which is what happened more and more, which is in operations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And operations includes, you know, a lot of what Daniel does every single day includes 3D modeling. It includes physical modeling, you know, with clay and hard models, foam models, those kind of things. But we have seen a new kind of direction nowadays, which is visualization, you know, in particular VR, augmented reality to a certain kind of degree. But we also have, of course, the studio engineering department. And you know, of course, the bigger you get, the more responsibility each subdivision, like studio engineering, would get. But in our idea. Let's say we're going to put an operations person in there who kind of, you know, collects everything and who's a direct line to the VP design in terms of, you know, just organizing literally everything in terms of a, in terms of an admin situation. Mm-hmm. IT is part of that, for example, as well. And I think what we see with all those kind of sub departments, and I think 3D is the best kind of example for that. We have a rather just a few amount of really permanently employed people within this area. And then based on the output on of the designers and based on the schedule of the projects, you know, we will be working with contractors and, you know, the,
right.
the contractors are, you know, I don't want to say a special bunch of people, but because they're not permanently employed, they have to be extremely flexible.
Yeah, definitely. But I would also go as far as really saying that, like, if you look at all the contract work which is done in the design studio, I would say they're really the backbone of the company, right? Because especially when you are a startup, you've got a certain amount of permanent people, which are obviously like creating the design and living the brand and also creating the design language. But in the end of the day, you still need the people to create the product, right?
Right.
And when you look at the industry, I would say most people who do like 3D modeling, whether it's Maya or Elias or IsomSurf, most of them at a certain stage when they have a certain senior level basically on skills, they go into freelancing because it's just really popular, right? And obviously it allows you as a contractor to look into different brands and different companies.
So I
think a lot of people think that's really interesting because like the most people you speak to, especially juniors, who have been at a place for maybe 2 years, 3 years, and they actually find harder to like find a permanent position at a really interesting brand. And it's way easier for them to become part of a project as a freelancer.
Yeah. Right.
So I think also the experience they are getting is different maybe than as it was maybe 10 years ago in Germany. Because obviously everything like the contracting business as itself is more like a UK-based thing.
Yeah.
But I would say at the moment there's no difference in Europe. Like contracting is popular.
Yeah, because the pressure has arisen, I think, in terms of financial pressure.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a
fundamental point. I mean, if you... The question is that those companies ask themselves, and it's sometimes really difficult, to, like, you know, really hard to say something like that. If you hire someone permanently, you pretty much have to a, you know, controlling department, a purchasing department, or like an HR department, guarantee that you can fully work with this person for 10 months a year, because the rest is like, you know, holidays and stuff like that. But let's say you only have, you know, the idea of, you know, 6 months of work. And then you have this person sitting around for 4 months. Of course, in bigger companies, that doesn't really happen. Or like, you know, it might happen, but not in a case that it really affects them a lot. But this is then where the contractors are coming in. So in a growing process in particular, you know, you can control your cash much better.
Yeah.
But also in terms of flexibility, because as you just mentioned, the pressure, especially with all the different projects coming along, usually... at the same time frame.
Yes.
It's more like a thing that the companies are not even planning like 6 months anymore. It's more like short notice and then deciding, like, it's more like, I don't really like the word, but like this agile approach, right? So it's more like...
Another way of saying disorganized.
We're basically thinking like this week, okay, what are we going to do next week? And on Thursday, we are realizing, okay, we need those people. And if you think about getting any people on board, like via traditional HR process, it's going to take weeks.
Exactly.
Even if you have the right candidate and he wants to sign a contract, it's going to take weeks to get him on board. Whereas as a contractor, on Monday, he's there. And I think this is like just the value of having those people who are willing
and
to
the flexibility.
Contract.
Well, in terms of like me and my gestalting car company, say I've gotten, you know, a huge series of financing in the first round. And then all of a sudden, you know, the economy just goes down the tubes. And all of a sudden I'm like, you know, scrounging just to pay the people that I do have on staff.
it would actually make more sense then to bring in, you know, or all of my projects are now getting canceled because I can't do three cars anymore. Yeah. I can only do one. So it makes a lot more sense to get in, you know, contract, because then I can scale up and down more
and
easily.
That's exactly the thing, is because, you know, those kind of times where you build a car and the product planning has been going back for years and years and years and years, those are over. It's a very reactional business nowadays, especially when you look into China, for example, where this kind of contract market is very, very appreciated because it gives you the flexibility. You know, it's, you know, even in, on our day-to-day level, and, you know, talking a little bit on Lichlec, you know, what we do, you get calls and just like, oh, I need people. And then 2 days later, oh, I don't need them anymore. It's because sometimes, you know, projects are being canceled. You have, you know, let's say billionaires or gazillionaires like yourself, saying just like, oh, I don't like this anymore. And, you know, start from scratch. And then you have to send everybody home.
Right.
And this obviously is, it's not the ideal situation, because, you know, the stability is always key, and you see it with products. The more stability you have in that, the better the products become.
Yes.
But I think in today's culture, because of those quick changes, you know, and especially in terms of then the executional part, which is, 3D modeling, which is clay modeling in particular, visualization and stuff like that. We see more work with contractors. We see more work with suppliers, but also as well, you know, like bigger suppliers, especially when it comes to like the clay facilities, where a lot of, you know, new OEMs or OEMs, even the big ones, they don't want to spend that money on internal people anymore. They'd rather go to a supplier and like, do it for us, because we only need you, like, you know, 6 months out of a year.
Right.
And it's in the end much cheaper for us, even though the project might be a bit more expensive, but in the long term it's cheaper for them. And I think this is something that is absolutely fundamental to grasp. Yeah. Mm. But it is a mix. I mean, we will never see a manager being a contractor nowadays.
I think the important thing, like when you build up the company, it's like what Martin said, it's like the healthy ratio, right? So you can't run a company just with permanent people, like you can do, but it won't make sense really. Like
it's not effective enough,
Whereas obviously, like if you have a company with 20% of permanent staff and the rest contractors, which you rely on, because in the end of the day, they're contractors, right? So if you can only promise them a 3 month because you don't know what's happening in the next quarter, and they accept the contract, they're gone, right? So a lot of companies actually underestimate that, right? It's different to a permanent person.
It's quite risky.
Yeah, it's just you have to get the ratio right, right? So, you, like, both extremes are unhealthy, really, right?
Right. Now, one thing that you mentioned earlier was that there's more kind of junior designers entering into this freelance lifestyle. And that was interesting because it seems like, you know, contractors, in my opinion, was always people that had a lot of experience, people that, you know, were once at a company and had a lot to bring to the table, and therefore decided that this kind of independent lifestyle was more beneficial for them in their life. But what's your percentage then in terms of, you know, the people that you work with? Would it be, I mean, what's the split between junior designers and top level modelers, for example, say in CAS modeling?
I mean, this really depends. Like what we try to do, like from day one, is obviously we work with, especially in CAS modeling, like with really experienced people, because usually when a supplier or an OEM gets people on board for a project, they've got a tight deadline and they need the right people on board to basically crack on. But we always try, like when we have projects which are not as hot, basically, to get new people on board, like people maybe the client hasn't worked with, or maybe even people we haven't worked with. So these might be like junior people who've got like 2 to 3 years experience at a supplier, and they decided to become freelancers to have a look at other companies, maybe even other countries. So we have a lot of people who are mid-20s, late-20s, no girlfriend, basically, no family, not attached. And they come to us and what's going on in China or what's happening in Sweden.
Right.
Yeah. And they are basically the people who are going up there for like half a year and just checking new places out and obviously gaining like this international experience, which with people like in their even if they're contractors in their mid-30s, late-30s, they got a family here, it's less likely they are going abroad for such a long time, which is obviously understandable, right? Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, one thing that we need to mention, which is that the companies are becoming more and more restrictive in terms of the hiring, actually. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because you obviously have labor councils and all these kind of things. And in particular over here in Germany, you know, you have a probation period, which is usually somewhere between 3 and 6 months. Mm-hmm. But then afterwards, if things are really not going well, which might happen, you know, it doesn't really happen very, very often, but it might happen. It's then really, really difficult to part ways again.
Yeah.
You know, and we have made the experience that sometimes the people are really not reluctant, but they just want to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially with young people and especially with young designers. I think the contracting side on the young designers is more about, I want to be sure.
Mm.
Yeah. And I want to make sure that this is the right environment for that person and stuff like that.
Right.
There are certain kind of options like, you know, limited permanent contracts that are pretty much the similar thing, you know. It then doesn't matter if you're a contractor or, you know, if you're limited, you know, from a limited perspective employed. But that's a fundamental point, and it comes back to this kind of flexibility, you know, where you want to say, like, how sure can I be? You know, a lot of people ask the questions, I want to be sure, how can I be sure? You know, how can you guarantee that this and that works? And the question is, there is no guarantee.
Yeah.
There's never a guarantee with a contractor. There's never a guarantee with a permanently employed person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So it really comes down to the right feeling and the right connection to each other and all these, you know, all these kind of, that's more like a soft skill and in the personal kind of perspective. And the contractors play exactly the same role. And as Daniel mentioned, you know, exactly on the kind of executional level, it is more likely that the younger guys will be hired because then they, you know, will be trained and all these kind of things, and so that makes a good process. But on really the experienced level, most of them, I mean, just look into Clay. I think nowadays Clay is still 90% contract.
Yeah,
you know.
But you staff across the entire kind of spectrum of design. I mean, in terms of contractors, you put people that are not permanent staff into color and trim studios, for example, or into these what types of teams do you work with? Of course, I understand, you know, the clay modeling aspect, the alias, modeling and surfacing. But do you, for designers, I mean, is there a contract, say I'm a different person now,
yeah.
I'll do a little role playing. I don't know, think of some girl's name, and I've just, I have a couple of years experience at an OEM and I've done some pretty good things in terms of color and trim, but I'm still single and I still want to go out there and find, you know, a different location in the world that I'd want to work in. Maybe, you know, California, say, is attractive to me, and there's an automaker over there that has an opening. Can I then just kind of get on their color and trim team, work 6 month contract? Do you do that?
Well, to be fair, I think, first of all, there are two different approaches really, right? So one approach would be us having a position open and people applying for it.
Mm-hmm.
But in your case, for example, if we'd be newly in touch, the first thing we would ask you is like, what do you want to do?
Mm.
Right? Like, obviously from the experience you have, like, what's your ambition? Like, not only like in terms of which country, but also career-wise.
Mm.
Because this really depends which company might suit you, right?
Right.
Whether it's a smaller company, maybe for like a small series production car, or maybe a big OEM or supplier.
Yeah.
And obviously depending on which country.
Yes.
And in your context, of course, I mean, you know, it always depends, like, what is the project? I mean, why would you want to go, if you come out of a permanent position, go into, for example, a 6 month contract? Where is the flexibility behind those things? I mean, when we go back to the studio environment and say, just like, okay, how do we want to build this?
Yes.
You know, the question is always just like, what are the kind of pillars that we need?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what are the kind of pillars that if people move on, they can be replaced? Yeah.
Yes.
And this is, in the end, a fundamental point as well. The designers, and, you know, I know a lot of people, you know, they are very, very happy when I say this, but the designers are still the main pillars of how a design studio works, because this is where the ideation coming from. Mm-hmm. This is where the creativity is coming from. And a lot of the modelers, no matter how good they are, mm-hmm. you know, they are enabling the designers, you know, to really bring this into a production.
That's right. That we they see just execute their... those people's ideas.
Exactly. And this sounds very, very harsh, but it's actually a very, very good job to do. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very important job to do. And we see that with clay modelers in particular, or like mm-hmm. the art modelers. I mean, those guys yes. are artists. If you've ever seen them work, it's absolutely ridiculous, you know, what they can do from a model, and like, you know, how good their eye is. Mm-hmm. The same thing.
Translating a 2D sketch.
Exactly. And 3D, exactly mm-hmm. the same. And, you know, visualization, I mean, doing something like in, you know, you see the picture and it looks like, you know, the whole thing stands and is in front of you.
Yeah, no, it's a piece of art, definitely.
It's a piece of art, but in the end, it's just like it enables the designer to bring whatever they do to life. And mm-hmm. and this is also why in a whole process and environment, of course, this is exchangeable, interchangeable. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have, let's say, a design team which is quite small and you have the best designer leaving, the impact is going to be incredible.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
It might be a very, very big impact if your best modeler leaves, but there will be ways to replace him in a relatively short amount of time with the designer. That's going to be very difficult, you know. And I think this is where the ratio is then coming down to, like, how to organize a studio and stuff like that, and how to run with it is really about, you know, can you really build a good creative team? Can that, you know, kind of feed each other in terms of ideas? Can it be creative enough? Is it really one? Mm-hmm. I think that's the big question. That's from the top dog to kind of, you know, then put it into place. But the executional kind of way, yeah, the kind mm-hmm. of modeling even. I mean, we've seen studios that were pretty much only designers, and then they've kind of, you know, brought in externals and said, it's like, I do it with the externals. And then, you know, whenever it's done, you know, we still have the designers. I mean, there's all different kinds of models.
So they outsourced everything in terms of execution. It was just designers. So junior to senior, I mean, probably their structure maybe skipped something. Maybe it was like junior, senior, and then director,
we had
one. Is that like a fully fledged studio?
There was one project some time ago that was pretty much where the where the client in the end said, we give you three of our guys and you just do the rest. In terms of finding the people,
right?
Yeah. So obviously we're not executing the projects and stuff, but it's really about then, you know, so there's three designers, those are the leads, and the rest is then going to be done with externals. I mean, this is the bring it in to the hardcore level that you can get to.
Yes.
And that is really not the norm. The norm is really that, you know, companies such as BMW, they would probably say, so we have a project and this project will go out to supplier. The supplier will do the clay modeling for them and most of the 3D modeling. Yeah. Yeah.
Build the show car,
of course, all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it is run by BMW's design department. Yeah. Right. If that is the designer, if there's a project manager, project leader, doesn't really matter what that, you know, position is really called in that regard. But it is still run by BMW and it will always be controlled by BMW, and they just outsource certain parts of the project.
Yes.
And I think this is also for us, I mean, you know, people have told us, like, you know, 3-4 years ago, it's like, oh, you know, contract will be dead, there's very, very point soon. No, you know, you will exactly need the mix of everything, because if we would really go into saying everything is permanent, it won't work, because you know, it's going to be at the long term too expensive.
Yeah, and you never know what you need from one project to the next.
Exactly, you know, and it makes a lot of sense in terms of also keeping the people moving, you know, for a whole industry.
Right.
Also trying out new things, for example.
Yes.
Like, you're way more flexible, like when you say you want to try
VR is a good example.
VR, for example, for the next project, and you can get it from an external supplier. That's great, but you would... For the first project, you probably wouldn't find the right people in time.
Yeah.
And getting them on board permanent position for a tryout.
Or training them.
Yeah.
Yes. Or training
unlikely.
Them.
Yeah.
Training them would be another option that takes a lot of time.
Yes.
You can hire, of course, people. So it really comes down. I mean, if you want to do your own car, you know, or, you know, you want to develop something, it really gets into that kind of that situation of really finding the right mix. And I think that's what a lot of companies have done already.
Mm-hmm.
They found the right mix, but obviously it always depends from company to company. Some people are more contract heavy, some people are more permanent heavy, you know. Mm-hmm. But as we can see, there's enough cars coming into the market,
right? Yeah, it's very, very interesting in terms of dynamic within the studio, because it's not, I mean, I don't know the inner workings of other industries quite as well as the design industry, but I don't think there's a lot of people that work on, you know, contract as much as they do in a in an automotive design studio. It seems like it's quite, you know, resource intensive in terms of getting contractors, getting temporary employees in on a contract basis.
Maybe not as many skill sets, I would say. I think the design studio just includes so many different skill sets you need for the design process, right? And apart from design, most things you can get on a contract basis if you would want to, right? And this obviously allows you quite a lot of flexibility depending on what your aim is.
And I think it also, I mean, in your case, so if you would say, okay, so I can spend a lot of money, you know, the things that you would like to control internally are really the marketing, because that's how you get, you know, the perception of the car is then going to be for the broad public. And the other thing is, of course, the design, because you want to know, you know, you want to control what, how it looks like.
Everybody's got an opinion.
Exactly. But in the end, it's just like, you know, the whole car industry, because of the complexity, have so many suppliers now, especially on engineering. You could really, if you have enough money, just say, I have two departments, you know, plus a few people who control the other people, the suppliers, and build a car company. I mean, this is, you know, to a certain degree, what eVelocity is doing at the moment. Where they have, you know, Richard Kins running the design department. You have a few guys running on the really top level and kind of try to coordinate everything. But the question is how long we can go with this kind of traditional, you know, let's say GM, BMW, Volkswagen kind of style, because they are slowly moving towards the supplier levels as well. So, it's not going to change. And it's the car industry, kind of as the last word, is just, it's too complex. You know, you cannot just say, I'm going to skip one step because it's just too complex. You know, like, I mean, you've seen it before. You know, we went to studios together and everything, and you know, if you see a clay model and you see like different things, you know, three kind of next to each other, and it's like, yeah, but that body side is exactly the same. Like, no, 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 it's not. Tiny little, you know, changes there. So then this is the thing. This is the complexity also in terms of design, of course.
So that's, I mean, I thought that was a really good conversation that we had from industry experts here, people that are building these design studios from scratch and filling it with
you help with this as well,
I'm working on it now as well, but I thought it was great to get Daniel's input. So thank you for joining us, special guest,
Mr. Daniel,
Daniel Schoenfeld. Thank you. But now I think, you know, on that note, I think we should kind of talk about the positions that we're actually looking to fill at the moment, which is Concept House. I mean, from my perspective, I'm looking for more senior level design candidates that are working on interiors and also exterior design and in Germany, but also further afield. I think you're also
looking that interior. That's the thing for us, the big, I mean, we had the change at the moment, UI UX as well. If you have experience in car, you know, in the car design industry with UI UX, please, you know, talk to us. We have quite a few things that
massive
we can talk about.
Massive opportunities in that field right now.
And, you know, Daniel, from a contract point of view, I think, you know, it's quite 3D heavy for you at the moment, or what's the deal?
Yeah, actually, if you're a clay modeler who's available, it's quite funny because last year it was exactly the other way around, as you probably all know. No, but seriously, like, what I wanted to mention as well, basically we are planning to do an academy, end of the year. So that's basically a Grasshopper Academy, because we recently spoke to quite a few people who, got some experience with Grasshopper, but never really got around to using the project because, it only really starts being picked up by different design studios now in the last year, really. So what we are planning is an academy for 1 week with basically someone who's quite good at Grasshopper. We already got that person, luckily. So on the homepage, we're going to put like a bit of a leaflet out. So if someone's interested, they can join the academy. I think we're going to start off with like 10 places at the beginning,
we'll,
just
we'll
as a trial.
We'll try to drop a link in so people can...
And just to tell the people, where is that going to be and what city? And
This is going to be in Munich, Germany. And time is going to be announced, but it should be end of the year when hopefully things are a bit slowing down. Because I think at the moment everyone's on holiday, and as soon as they're back... it's going to be quite busy again.
Says the contract guy.
Got to hit the ground running after summer.
Good, good. Well, thank you for that. So yeah, I mean, I guess now we're just going to wrap it up. Everybody in the car design industry, in Europe anyway, I mean, you know, whole design studios are just shut for the month of gone. So we're going to take a little holiday ourselves, and we're going to come back and shoot episode 7.
Yes.
When I come back then in...
Beginning of September.
So we're going to skip the next kind of, you know, you're not going to see us in 2 weeks. It's going to be a month, you know, so 4 weeks. So sorry to let you down, but you're going to have to wait. But all good things come to those who wait. And then we, of course, you know, by all means... Look us up. We're on YouTube now. We're also on iTunes. We've got the
Spotify.
We've got Spotify. We're all over the map. So
do like us. Do subscribe.
Like us. Share the links. You know,
5-star ratings on iTunes are always great.
Always nice. Always nice.
And
please comment as well, because we want to know what you guys think. I mean, you know, now we got Daniel in the mix. Over there. Do you like Daniel? Do you want to see him again? Maybe not. You know, let us know. But this is always fun. So yeah, by all means, you know, look us up. And next time for September, we'll probably do a little Paris preview.
Pebble Beach review.
And yes.
if we can get it all sorted, we have some plans. I mean, we promised actually last time we wanted to get guests on board.
Oh yeah,
for this one. Unfortunately,
holiday.
No, he's unfortunately on holiday. He has some personal problems. But you know. We are very, very good in the process of hopefully bringing someone in for the next recording. So there will very likely be 3 of us again, maybe even 4 if Daniel wants to join again.
Good stuff.
And in that kind of sense, you know, like us, subscribe and everything else. And we will see you in beginning of September, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Cool. See you soon. Take care.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.